You are listening to WRIR 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA. Open Source RVA is WRIR's weekly news digest. Formerly known as Open Source, the show is now under new management, and we will be coming to you at a new time, every Friday at 4 p.m. Today on Open Source RVA, we'll be talking about the current brouhaha over city chickens and having a frank discussion about the state of Richmond schools. I'm Don Harrison, and here are some of the top stories making headlines right now. Talks about a baseball stadium in Shaco Bottom are back. Reports emerged this week that city officials, business leaders, and the Richmond Flying Squirrels are once again looking at the Shaco Bottom area as a location for a new ballpark. The debate, as always, centers on the need to replace the aging Diamond on the boulevard, which is the Squirrels' current home field. Replacing the 26-year-old stadium was a de facto term of the agreement that brought the Squirrels here in 2010. The possibility of Shaco as a new home was first discussed in 2003, but died on the vine as the city was just awakening to the district's historical significance as a center of the 19th century domestic slave trade. The idea cropped up again in 2005 as part of a massive plan to redevelop the bottom that would have included condos and shops and would have converted the 17th Street Farmers Market into a promenade. That plan also died under heavy public scrutiny, in part because of the damage it might have done to historic places. Lumpkin's Slave Jail, now part of the historic slave trail, would have been under a proposed parking deck. At least one source familiar with this ongoing debate told Open Source RVA that if this latest proposal doesn't succeed, he wouldn't be surprised to see the Flying Squirrels follow the Braves out of town to greener pastures. In October of last year, the Times-Dispatch reported that Pat O'Connor, president of Minor League Baseball, said he'd been contacted by the Squirrels' management about a possible move. The concern? That there was no workable plan to replace the Diamond. A recent review published in the Richmond Times-Dispatch has once again highlighted an unusually high death rate for inmates at the Richmond Jail. The paper's report, which found the jail's inmate death rate to be more than twice the national average, reinforces a report that first appeared in Style Weekly in 2009. Last month, Katrina Jones, a 19-year-old prisoner, died after being found strangled in her cell. She'd tried to hang herself once before in front of deputies, but a jail mental health evaluation determined she posed no threat to herself shortly before her death. Though the most recent analysis by Dr. Mark Stern does not link the high rate of deaths at the Richmond Jail to inadequate medical treatment, the Style Weekly report found that since taking office in 2006, Sheriff C.T. Woody has decreased spending on critical drugs used to treat mental illness and HIV/AIDS. It's decreased from 1 million yearly to just 200,000. 60 people have died while in the Richmond Jail since 2000, mostly of natural causes, but the jail faces a number of wrongful death suits. There's a lot to do this weekend, including the 29th annual Watermelon Festival, slated for Sunday in Carytown. There will be dozens of bands and performers on hand at the event, which is expected to draw 75,000 visitors. There'll be 100 exhibitors and a massive kids' play area, not to mention thousands of watermelons. The weather looks like it might cooperate with outdoor plans, with forecasts calling for 90-degree weather and partly cloudy skies on Saturday and Sunday. You're listening to Open Source RVA on 97.3 LPFM, WRIR. Now, let's pass it over to Chris Dovey. He has some special guests in the studio to help us understand the politics of poultry.
Today we'll be talking turkey with Valerie West and Britta Cruz, members of Chickens, and with City Councilman Marty Jewell about an effort to legalize chickens in backyards throughout the metro area. After that, Councilman Jewell will stick around and will be joined by 2nd District Richmond School Board member Kimberly Gray, as well as Kirsten Gray, a mother of two Richmond school children and a longtime commentator on Richmond Public Schools, about the school district's recent efforts to rezone the city schools' attendance boundaries. So thanks for tuning in to this very first episode of Open Source Rebooted. We've all flown the coop. We've been warned to don't count your chickens before they hatch. Some of us feel a bit henpecked sometimes, and others are proud as a rooster. And of course, there's the universal question, what came first, the chicken or the egg? A version of that question is being asked by chickens, a plucky coalition of concerned citizens ruffling feathers in Richmond, Chesterfield, and Henrico, and they're hoping that all three localities might change their laws to allow residents to keep so-called urban chickens. Recently, Richmond City Council agreed to study the matter. Today, we're talking with a couple of members of Chickens, Valerie West and Britta Cruz, and with 5th District Councilman Marty Jewell, who joined his peers to study the issue. So, Chickens, as I understand it, formed just about a year ago this time on an online forum rallying around Henrico's decision to take action against one of its founders, Copeland Cassati. She had been keeping illegal chickens in her backyard for years. You guys do not have chickens, is that right?
I had chickens and was fined several months ago.
So, real quick, Henrico and Chesterfield, you guys have not really made too much in the way of headway there, is that right?
The last update that I received from one of the council members was that certainly if the city of Richmond would make a change in their ordinance, that it would probably be more likely that Henrico would consider it. To me, an ordinance is there to protect the citizens, and clearly in this case, the citizens didn't need protections. I was informed by the planning board manager that it was against Henrico County's policy to take complaints that were internally generated.
And they went ahead and cited you anyway.
They cited me anyways, and they cited me as soon as I let them know that I intended to fight the decision, because I really felt that in this case there was no complaint from any neighbors, and everybody was in agreement. So
chickens, why do we want them?
Because they're good for you.
They're good for you.
The eggs are good for you. They're healthier. I have 4-year-old twins. Wasn't quite equipped to have a dog yet, so we decided that the chickens would make great pets, and
now,
they do.
And you guys were talking before the show a little bit about some community benefits to chickens. Can you talk a little bit about those?
You mentioned mosquitoes earlier tonight, and that's one thing that chickens eat, are mosquitoes, their larvae, their eggs.
Okay.
They eat fleas, ticks.
Excellent. All right. Well, so, Marty, you're from Goochland, right?
Originally? Country boy from Manikin in Goochland County.
So
yeah,
you have a little experience with chickens.
Grew up with chickens. Grandma had chickens. She had guinea hens. She had ducks. She had turkeys. She had it all.
Anything that quacked, squawked, or
absolutely. And to today, I'm loathe to find anybody who can give me the downside for having chickens. So it's a little silly.
I have heard some people say, well, we don't want them. They make noise. They smell flies. I've heard some arguments that are
sound legit. Give me a break. We're talking about a limited number of chickens allowed in someone's backyard. To oppose chickens is just silly. It's just silly. You're not talking to everybody. Everybody doesn't want them. You probably would have no more than 2 people on a block who would actually raise chickens. You're not talking about allowing roosters. That's not allowed. And so we're going to study it. The city's going to take a look at it.
Now, let me ask you that.
Why conversation?
Why study? I mean, this is something that when it went away, it was sort of a study. It was, I believe, as I recall, 1998. And it was an issue with dogs running at large. And a councilman had brought forward this issue to city council and ended up being a study of that. And animal control sort of tossed in as an extra, hey, by the way, we'd like to go ahead and make chickens illegal. Without any further comment in the record that I was able to find, they just sort of did that.
No one has presented a downside, a real downside.
There's some economic benefits to having chickens as well. I guess the city has a fairly high poverty rate. In fact, I believe it's the highest in the state. It's certainly pretty high. And keeping backyard chickens was one of these things that back in the, Depression era.
Any kind of major catastrophe could come through here at any time. and we don't have the means to feed ourselves. If there is a long-term outage of electricity and water and all the rest, what the hell are people to do? We're just getting hip to neighborhood gardens, community gardens, and we're having fun proliferating gardens around town, which is a good thing. But we're just on the beginning edge of that.
Right.
The garden should have chickens because that's where the fertilizer is going to come from.
That's what I'm trying to tell you.
Yeah. Cherish chickens. The waste parts
for fertilizer.
Plants.
Yeah.
Okay. So you guys were talking a little bit, too, about other benefits, community-wide benefits to keeping chickens.
Currently, 50% of the garbage in the United States is food.
Okay.
Which that really didn't surprise me.
It's not couches, not old television sets.
Nope.
It's food.
50% of it is food, which clearly we could keep out of the landfill. We could either feed it to chickens, or we could also use a compost system. So 230 million tons of waste per year. And clearly the recycling is slightly increasing. So it increased actually from 32% in 2009 to 34% in 2012. However, during that same time frame, the garbage production in this country has gone up 60%.
Wow.
So clearly we're not putting... If 2,000 households would keep chickens, it would reduce the waste sent to our landfills by 260 to 300 tons annually. In utopia, where every household in the United States would keep a small flock of chickens, we would reduce the amount of waste in the landfills by 115 million tons.
Now, by small flock, what are we talking about here?
I mean, 4 to 6 chickens.
4 to 6 chickens is what you'd like. So there would be limitations on how many chickens that you'd even want.
I really think that a limitation is a good idea.
Can you tell me exactly what you'd like to see in the city in terms of an ordinance? How would you?
We'd like for there not to be restrictions on lot size to have a small flock of hen. To eat your food scraps, give a household enough eggs.
I think the number I've heard is 8. No more than 8.
We did say 8 so that a flock of 4 could be replaced with a flock of four.
Oh, so you're cycling through hens. What's the laying cycle for hens?
About 3 years.
3 years, okay. And how many eggs do you expect off of a...
Off a flock of 3 to 4, you probably get dozen to a dozen and a half a week.
It's a lot of eggs.
It's a lot of eggs.
Or more.
Enough for a household and to share with their neighbors.
And there's some studies that I've read a little into that show that what you're getting from a backyard chicken is healthier.
You know what's going in that chicken.
Even
you're feeding that
cholesterol chicken. Levels are lower.
Cholesterol levels are lower. Nutrients are higher.
All right, Mari,
and they taste better.
You grew up with them, so do they taste different?
Well, that's been a long time ago. But you're right. You know what they're eating, number one. Number two, God only knows what they're doing to treat our chickens from processing, not only while they're alive, but even after they're dead. We don't know. But I remember chickens that we ate that were killed and fed to us had yellow skin. This chicken is all white-skinned chicken, and I'm saying, what the hell is this? What's going on with this poor chicken?
It's a different animal.
Well, yeah. And so I'm no scientist here, but I am saying that we've all known for a long time that our food has been tricked up and in ways that none of us ought to feel real safe about.
Now, how would the city feel about people, because I'm assuming we're talking here about cycling through. If you had 8 chickens, something happens with those other 4 at some point. So I would assume that we're maybe eating them.
After they're laying chickens and they're laying no more, they become eating chickens and you recycle them.
Well, now, could that be politically an issue, I guess, getting that past the more squeamish council members?
We love our chickens. My children love our chickens. But I do think that unless you are a vegetarian, you certainly should know that in order for you to eat that chicken nugget, that something living has to die. So if you're willing to buy it at the store, I certainly don't understand that people would have a problem in humanely killing an animal if there is such thing as humanely killing an animal.
Well, let's not kid ourselves about this stuff. You can't eat the darn thing unless you kill it.
So the circle of life happens even where there's a lot of pavement, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. Okay. Sure.
And actually, to some of those stats that you were referring to, pasture-raised chickens have a third less cholesterol, a quarter less saturated fat, two-thirds more vitamin A, two times more omega-3 fatty acids, three times more vitamin E, seven times more beta-carotene, and four to six times as much vitamin D.
So this is a power-packed vitamin in a...
So by the time an egg that you buy at the grocery store gets to you, it's at least a month old.
Whoa. Whoa. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. How long does an egg last?
Oh, several months if it's refrigerated.
Really? Wow.
But there certainly is a difference in the taste and also in the nutritional value. And these stats have actually been verified by two independent labs. So.
Wow. Okay. That's interesting. Do you guys have any estimate of how many people you think maybe have chickens in the city?
There are hundreds of households with chickens in the city. Hmm. And they just don't go, they go unnoticed because they're not a nuisance. They're not bothering anyone. The neighbors are getting free fresh eggs.
Everybody's
They're happy. Not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly have found through the chickens group, almost on a weekly basis, somebody is accidentally discovered and kind of reaches out to us. Oh, my God, what do I do now? And so when you sell hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of birds at the local feed store, where do the council members think those chickens are going?
Right. So now you guys have a website or a Facebook page, or do you want to say what that is? Or?
We have a Facebook page.
It's called Chickens, C-H-I-C-K-U-N-Z.
Educated
Copeland
group.
Cassati started this, the Facebook page, a couple years ago, but I believe she started the chickens movement 4 to 5 years ago.
Yes. Hmm. She has been at it for a very long time.
And she's been doing coop tours, right? I didn't know that there was any
formal... Yeah, we were part of that.
Okay.
There's been two...
once we were ousted, it was all fair game.
I guess you can still show off what's the house.
Well, we brought some chickens in for the day, so...
Okay. Interesting. And it is easy to take care of them?
Yeah. Much less trouble and work than any dog or cat, I promise you that.
And they become friends. I remember being taught how to hypnotize a chicken. Hypnotize a chicken, and she just sits there until you wake her up.
How do you hypnotize
as a kid?
Chicken? All right. Well, good luck to you guys, and good luck to you always.
Well, I'm sure we're going to need all of your old advocacy. Don't let up.
When can we expect to hear something about the report presentation? I heard they were given 30 days to do the report, to give a recommendation.
And this is actually... feedback from the administration to determine what difficulties they might envision if we allow chickens and there needs to be some kind of enforcement. And so otherwise, there's no real downside. They can't invent any, and I wouldn't think it would take more than 30 days.
Thank you to Valerie West and Britta Cruz, and, of course, 5th District Councilman Marty Jewell for coming on today to talk a little bit about this. And we'll be back in just a minute. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Back with Open Source on WRIR. Today we're with City Councilman Marty Jewell, and we're joined now by School Board Member Kimberly Gray and by Kirsten Gray, a member of the Grassroots Lobby and Advocacy Group Alliance for Progressive Values, as well as a parent of two Richmond students who is, by the way, no relation to Kim. This spring, the Richmond School Board took up what is perhaps one of the most important, though also one of the rarest duties that it has, redistricting schools, deciding attendance boundaries for all of the roughly 45 schools. And determining those attendance boundaries is of critical significance, of course, to parents, but also to communities in which those schools are located. Early in the process, I was at one of the first public hearings on this process, and I had the opportunity to talk with a few members of the committee. Most of them are parents. And I was surprised when each of them told me that they were directed not to allow some pretty fundamental issues into the process. They said they'd been instructed not to allow it to become political, and they'd made an effort as well to ignore race and class in drawing what were then proposed boundary options. Tell us a little bit about where we are right now.
Where we are right now is they came up with recommendations without looking at race or class, and they presented a proposal to repurpose four schools within the city. John B. Carey Elementary, Summer Hill, Southampton or Fisher, and the fourth school
is Bellevue. Keep talking about, I guess, is with some of these higher performing schools closing them. There are lower performing schools that have not entered the conversation at all as, well, let's look at those schools to close. Is that...
It speaks to the offerings at those buildings. For instance, Bellevue is a blue ribbon school, and it's performing very well. John B. Carey has the only NASA program in the region. So there's some assets.
And NASA program is?
Math and science program that they...
So it's STEM.
Science, technology, engineering, and math program. Many of the considerations were whether or not it was walkable or not.
So, Kirsten, you had started to talk a little bit about magnet schools. And in fact, there are a number of things that I guess...
Well, I think they have to increase enrollment. I mean, I take issue when you have kids on waiting lists to get into overpacked schools, and then you have a school that's operating at half capacity. And somehow you got to draw kids into these half-empty schools.
And magnet schools might be.
It might be magnet. Or I'm all for some schools repurposing. I mean, an example is this. IB program at Lucille Brown. I think it was 387 students applied. They're all pre-qualified. That means they all would do well there for the most part. 75 accepted. Where did most of those kids go? You hear of a couple getting into Albert Hill, a couple going to Henderson, and you hear a lot of them going to private schools. That's a huge loss. I mean, I don't want to close any schools, but there needs to be some rearrangement where we're not losing these kids to Trinity. We're not losing them to St. Michael's. I mean, that's what's happening. They want to use Richmond Public Schools.
Kathy Graziano and I don't always agree, but I really was impressed with what she said, perhaps after the last public hearing for school zoning. And that is, the superintendent's going to have to make a decision as to whether she wants a school system for poor black kids and poor black kids alone, or does she want schools for everybody? And I think she's right in asking that question. And there are indicators that suggest that maybe it is not the case that that is what this superintendent wants, or this is not what this superintendent knows how to get. And whatever is the case, we need to get in a room and get this one figured out and get it out, figured out once and for all, because we may well be going into all of this rezoning business with the totally wrong precepts imaginable in order to get the right outcome.
Is it ever realistic to go into this process thinking it could be a non-political?
It's dumb as dirt to think it's not going to be political. It's always political. Their job is to reapportion. That's what rezoning is, not closing schools. That's a byproduct of your reapportionment.
But the school board is going to have to deal with the possibility of some school closures, right?
I think that one of the major concerns that I have is we are in a budgetary crisis. We have not come out of it with this budget process. Sure. We are entering our next year's budget with at least a $12 million hole. The desired schools have students coming from every corner of the city, and if they can get in.
And this is through open enrollment.
Through open enrollment. enrollment. So if they can get in and their parent has a vehicle or means to get them to that school building, because we don't provide transportation.
Are you keeping out certain kids then?
There are certain children that will not have access because the families don't even own a car and don't have a means to get their children to those desirable locations. So there does need to be some way to equalize it.
If you closed schools, and let's say we looked at the schools that are on the list to close, and I'm asking for a parent's perspective here. If you were to close a school that was a high-performing school, a trustworthy school like J.B. Carey, and then folded that into another school that was a lower-performing school, would parents go to the lower-performing school, assuming that what came from the higher-performing school was going to be transferred to the lower-performing school?
John B. Carey, I think, has the student body is mostly from open enrollment, not the neighborhood. So if you close that school, they're not going to go to their district school. They just left their district school.
Open enrollment was on the table here, too.
I don't think open enrollment was on the table as much as it would. By increasing the end zone participation at particular schools, then just by doing the math, you would lose open enrollment slots. So it jeopardizes a lot of people's opportunity to attend those schools. Now, I advocate for a more purposeful, measured phasing out of students who've been attending a school, for instance, for 3 to 4 years, and then we implement this new rezoning process. I'd rather, you know, the snake swallow the egg and have a little bit of overcrowding.
Time to digest it a little?
Yeah, for at least to allow those students an opportunity to finish where they started and have that community that's been behind them stay with them, and they can move out and go on to middle school. So,
and that is what we're trying to do in the city, right, is to create communities.
Create communities,
interest
yes.
In schools.
But the process did not call for that. Initially, the plan was that as soon as those end zone people came in, it would push out the out-of-zone students because they wouldn't, you know, there wouldn't be enough room to accommodate all of them. I think that there's a way that we can figure out to accommodate those end-zone students until they matriculate onto middle school.
Marty, you had started to say something.
Number one, it just seems to me that there needs to be more data-driven management going on in Richmond Public Schools. We knew that we were having an annual precipitous decline in student population. 4 years ago, when Wilder was in office, school board swore and declared that we can't close any elementary schools. That's where all of our population is. By no means can we close elementary schools. Here we're talking about 3.5 years later, we're going to close 4. Jesus Christ, give me a break here. And maybe 5. Because they're consolidating schools over there where the new schools are being built. So we knew that this day was coming, and we failed to act, number one. Number two, I don't know whether we've got a vision for schools. I hear you allude to one. I hear you allude to one, Kim. But I don't know that the superintendent has a vision for schools. And in the absence of it, we're sort of in a...
It's interesting.
Neverland.
It's interesting that Ms. Graziano would I guess state it the way that she did.
Yeah.
She put it in very stark terms.
Yes.
And it sort of goes back to what Kim was talking about.
That's
it's
right.
A tale of two school districts.
And it doesn't have to be that way.
No, it doesn't.
Let me just make this point real fast. I look at 4 elementary schools 3 years ago, 4 years ago. You had Fox, Munford, Fisher, and Swansboro. All 4 high performing schools. But 3 of them were predominantly white and affluent. You had Swansboro, high-performing school, yet it was overwhelmingly African-American and poor. But that didn't matter because I figured out 3 common denominators that allowed the 4 to function at high-performing level regardless the socioeconomic matters. And that is, 1, all 4 schools had excellent leadership, excellent principal, strong with vision, who knew what they were doing. 2 was all 4 schools had a maximum parental involvement. Swansboro Elementary had Otis Mallory's wife back then, who was president of PTA, standing room only every month. It was astounding to me. It's a thing of
the
beauty.
PTA.
PTA.
We have some PTAs in the city that are four or five parents, don't we?
Or less.
Yes.
Or two parents.
So, and then the third was excellent community support. My point is that if you see to it that all of our schools have those three elements, mm-hmm. we're home free.
So you
but
found,
it's going to take time. It's going to take time.
It is the recipe, I agree.
It is the recipe. I mean, you need good leader.
Yeah.
You need neighborhood involvement.
Yes.
But you also still need room for open enrollment.
Well, wouldn't your hope be, though, that all of your schools have that involvement? You don't
yeah.
need open enrollment, right?
Actually, a lot of the schools that move up have open enrollment. A lot of the high, when you're talking about the high performing schools like Bellevue, John B. Carey, Fox, it all started with open enrollment being part of the equation.
So it allows parents to choose their school. And
but
to
eventually, there's no room. I mean, eventually, there's just no room. But I think it's a slow process, and I don't think it, you know, I don't want to see school administration mess with that. When you see a successful school, don't mess with it. Now, if you have a successful school that's grossly under-enrolled, you need to do something
sure.
to increase enrollment.
Well, I think that's a question of what came first, the chicken or the egg, because you're going to have a desire of folks to migrate into those school buildings even when it's not their school zone, when they see the success rate, when they see the mm-hmm. good things that are happening, and it's just the nature of what happens. I don't know that they became successful through open enrollment. Yeah, I do know that even at Fox, we have parents from Woodland Heights. We have parents from all across the city who contribute a great, great deal of their time, their energy, their funds. You know, they write grants. They do a lot of wonderful things.
The very first key ingredient to me, though, I mean, it's not the open role. I think it's part of the equation. It's a good leader and who is not afraid of letting the community be involved.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, and so it's not just open enrollment. I'm just saying that a lot of the good schools that you're talking about do have open enrollment as part of the component there.
Let's face it. We got some race issues too that need to be cleared up.
Well, can I bring? Well, that's why I wanted to point out Houlton too. It is the most racially diverse and income diverse school.
But it was built. Where there was greater need somewhere else than it was in that white neighborhood.
Houlton got their school building at the expense of Carver Elementary. And
I
think
okay.
that Carver Elementary has been on that list. They've been patient.
Sure.
They've been waiting. That school building is not in very good shape. I mean, there is an addition, a later addition to the building that's probably okay. But if you go in that school, you can see that the facility is lacking.
Now, that's an interesting
case,
because you see at Carver, they've tried over the years, and they've had varying degrees of success with it, mm-hmm. where they will go in with programs trying to build that stool to add the legs.
And Carver has an excellent principal there, and Mr. Brickhouse. He's an awesome leader. I've seen a lot of growth there and great successes, but that school needs a lot more resources, and it needs community involvement, and it definitely needs a strong parental piece. And we have parents there who do not have transportation, mm-hmm. who do not have the ability to come to evening meetings, and they have children. I mean, we need to be able
Most of those kids from Gilpin.
A big majority of those kids are from Gilpin, and they have multiple children in the household. So it's very difficult when you're working and you're maybe working an hourly job, so you can't take off and spend time in the school. And to be able to contribute at the level that some of the other schools have, parents contributing. But it can happen. I think we have to work on removing mm-hmm. the barriers that mm-hmm. are in place that create an environment where you don't have that PTA involvement and parental
Hugely
piece.
Hugely important.
Well, I wanted to mention one other school that's an example of some diversity and success that's in an old building. It's called Albert Hill.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a new building.
But it's a historic building.
So is Bellevue. And it suffers major under-enrollment, and it's not ADA compliant.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
it's getting there.
Okay, but Albert Hill right now, now the rezoning would change it. But Albert Hill right now my daughter just graduated from there.
Mm-hmm.
So you got the zone, I guess, essentially of the upper fan, right? Carver, Mm-hmm. And I think even Gilpin Court, right?
Carver is fed by Gilpin Court and parts of Northside.
And they go to Albert Hill.
Yes.
Currently. Those neighborhoods.
You have Newtown.
West.
And Carver community. Actually, right across Belvedere, where I live, and Jackson Ward is feeding into Clark Springs. Yes, Gilpin is a big piece of Carver.
Okay, but that's it. I mean, basically, the zone right now for Albert Hill crosses all kinds of racial and income mm-hmm. neighborhoods,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
And it's fine. It's a good school.
It is.
So what's going to change it with the rezoning that I have issues with? So right now, actually, where the zone is...
The proposed rezoning.
Yeah, the proposed. the way it is fine. People are still trying to get in through lottery in this school with a very mixed population. I think it's a school, like Holton's beautiful. I think it represents our city the way it looks and
the
way we know it.
That's right.
Okay? Now, that proposed rezoning, they have it now. It would chunk out Carver.
It changed the feeder school.
It would chunk out all the poor neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Okay? And it goes just through the upper fan and north side. Oh. North side to the point where even Holton parents question it, where they're there one block, two blocks, four blocks away from Henderson. And all of a sudden, Albert Hill is their walkable school.
Is that right?
That's right.
There's some dog in that cat.
Yeah, okay, yeah. And now I'll tell you, what was funny, a friend of mine from Holton and I, we were at one of the first rezoning meetings when they presented all the four different plans. Mm-hmm. And we saw that and just laughed. I mean, it was like instant, like, did you see what I just saw?
I remember you pointing it out to me.
And then, lo and behold, if... They go through the four plants, and those are the two that are still standing. Mm-hmm. So they're going to, you know, this is a successful school that people are trying to get into that crosses all these racial and income
absolutely.
Barriers. So why are you going to mess with that?
I agree, and I've asked that same question, and the Mr. Crocker, the consultant, said they didn't consider race and they didn't consider income. But if we look at, and we're allowed to look at, free and reduced lunch populations. It markedly decreased the free and reduced lunch population, the proposal that's on the table. And when we talk about income in Richmond, we know it runs parallel with race.
Could you, in doing a redistricting or rezoning, take the schools that are successful, of course, but also the schools that are representative of our city, mm-hmm. and preserve those district lines? Or would that be, I mean, that would create some salamander districts
around
them, right?
There's a domino effect right now. When you start messing with one area and one zone,
you're forced to. Mm-hmm.
You're forced to look at other mm-hmm. things. So it has to be done in the aggregate as a whole. You can't just look at pockets in the city.
But so how do you preserve something like an Albert Hill if you
well,
have...
Well, the problem with what happened with Albert Hill is the feeder schools changed.
Okay.
So they were looking at what elementary schools should feed what middle schools. And Carver was taken out of the equation, and another school was put into the equation because those families get in through open enrollment, and it was desirable for them to be able to just be able to get in through the zoning process. Is it fair? I don't think so. And I think that we need to really reconsider how that school will look after if this proposal on the table were to go through.
It's telling, I think, in this entire conversation, how it is difficult to stay only on the topic of rezoning.
Mm-hmm.
And this conversation has moved off into race. It's moved off into class. It's moved off into how the school district transports children. This is an issue that is just vast. It's
huge. But again, that's the reason I contend that at very minimum, you reapportion based on population and moving lines first, before you get into these other considerations. Otherwise, you have just queered the deal. And I'm afraid they queered the deals talking about closing schools before they did the reapportionment. it makes it 10 times more complex. It's already complex.
Are we accounting for business?
Well, you've got George Mason, you've got Fairfield Court, you've got Woodville, all in that same area, and mm-hmm. those schools are packed to the gills. And the suggestion on the table for why Bellevue should not close is that it can relieve some of the pressure on those school buildings and accommodate those students who are right there in the East End. It makes sense, and the school is performing
well.
They
shut down the roundhouses at Mosby, which was used as an elementary school.
Well, it was Head Start students mm-hmm. there.
Head Start
yes.
school, number one. But then they did the weirdest thing and crammed all those kids in those schools in the East End. Some years ago,
mm-hmm.
and they haven't gotten that thing straightened out yet.
Mm-mm.
And so it just makes sense. Yes, Woodville is overloaded, but mm-hmm. most of the north side of Churchill is where your children are. There aren't that many children in the south side of Churchill because
no.
that's where your white, older population has migrated to. They don't have children.
Well, the Bellevue.
So they
can want what they want. They don't have the population to support the school.
Well, they don't have babies. I mean,
that's my point.
And that's his point.
Well,
so let me ask this.
I do want to say that the rezoning committee was made up of very, very invested community members, parents, and they did the best work they could with what they were given. They were not allowed to look at those things. So I think that they did a good job with what they had.
Well, I don't want to browbeat them.
I am
looking at with a jaundiced eye as your consultant.
There's a miscommunication and a disconnect with what the consultant was told the board wanted. And
right.
I think that we need to revisit the whole process, but I don't want to throw out the work of those people either.
We're way into the process at this point, having to now, I mean, we really don't have pretty much time to go back and readdress and restart the process, do we?
No, we don't. But I think that we did gather a lot of useful, very, mm-hmm. very useful information out of the rezoning process, and the committee has brought forward great suggestions. I think that the real issue right now is how we move forward. Mm-hmm. We have to make some decisions very quickly about what's going to happen on the south side. We know Summerhill is going to close. That was already on the agenda to close because the school is very old and it needs to
it's
be taken
to be absorbed by the other
new schools that are coming
your
online.
Your suggestion that we need to close two schools and commit to that, one was easy.
One was very easy.
Yeah.
I think that at the middle school level, I do think that we could do more with the IB program. It is the only draw at the middle school level that we see. We have kids who are, their families are exiting Richmond Public Schools at the fourth grade level just to assure mm-hmm. that their children.
I'm afraid we're going to bounce into a completely different topic, mm-hmm. but and I've written quite a bit about the IB program of late. And the middle school is something that I've not written yet about, but in looking at it, the city, I think that Kirsten brought this up, is that they it's a not a by invite only, but you have to get in to that program. Elsewhere, that program, in fact, I don't believe that IB itself requires any sort of an application process.
Well, and Henrico. They do have an application mm-hmm. process. Some
but
of the
IB,
other localities,
IB, which is implemented by this multinational, it's a mm-hmm. it's an NGO that oversees it. They don't have any sort of application process or
no, but no, they do have criteria.
And that's what parents want.
There is a. It's not for gifted students, but it is for students who do well with a lot of rigor. It is mm-hmm. it is a very rigorous program. There are lots of requirements, and it is monitored through the International Baccalaureate organization. So that extra set of eyes on the school is what I think causes parents to say, "I believe in this. It's mm-hmm. it's a brand that we can trust. We want to send our kids there." But when you have close to 400 applicants and only 75 slots, and those 75
That's a problem.
In interviewing parents of the middle school IB program and parents, I guess, outside of that, just in talking to parents and kids, too, at that school, and again, we were talking about the tale of two schools. It seems that that school is a tale of two schools all by itself in many ways. I was hearing stories about the separation between the two populations in that school.
There is.
And that's very unusual, I think. And when you look at, just to give by example, IB in a district that doesn't require any sort of full disclosure, my wife works in Hanover, so I have to say that. But in looking at the data for all of our area, our four area school districts, the IB program in Hanover does not have any requirements saying you have to apply to get into a class. Mm. And so what you saw was huge participation compared to any of the other three districts. Richmond aside, I mean, what they're doing there is far and away different than what Henrico and Chesterfield are doing.
Right.
Well, they allow any child to take a class.
Right. But there are application processes in Henrico, for instance, where students are identified as IB students. Now, they don't...
They're using it as a magnet program.
Yes, but that doesn't preclude other students within that school building
from taking
IB courses. In Richmond, it is run differently, and I think it's a capacity issue.
So if you happen to be at Moody in Henrico County and you decide you wanted to take whatever the theory of knowledge or whatever IB class it is that you're interested in, but you're not in IB and you've not been tracked IB.
If there's a space, you can
take it.
You can take that class, yes.
Why do we not allow that in Richmond?
I don't think we have put in enough resources and enough seats, and we have, I mean, IB keeps a waiting list at the middle school level, especially, and at Thomas Jefferson at
resources,
the high school.
Teachers?
We don't have enough teachers, enough seats in those classrooms to accommodate additional students. We are at capacity for the IB students that are actually enrolled, that are required to take those courses. So I think it's the design of the program. I know that Lucille Brown is right now with their end zone capacity, they are at capacity. So IB is seen in that building by many of the parents who live in zone as, you know, taking up space that students who live in that school zone could utilize.
So stealing from the poor to give to the rich.
That's how a lot of people perceive it. So there is conflict between the IB students and non-IB students and the faculty and parents. So it does create a bit of a contentious environment that doesn't allow everyone to reach their potential.
It's sort of ironic
when
you think... The
problem is nobody does anything about it.
It's ironic
if it walks like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, damn it, it's probably a duck.
Well, there's some... It's ironic that you're talking about the three-legged stool, and there you have the pieces and parts. You're just not assembling the stool. You have parents that are involved and interested in their child's education. You actually have a second population that is frustrated that their children, who are the zoned children, are not getting the resources. The principal must be okay enough that they're trusting her with an IB program. Mm-hmm. And a community that wants to be involved in that because this is a premier program.
But parents that are divided because of the two programs.
It's two schools within a school. It is, as I said, the tale of two schools within a city. We have two schools within a school. And it creates a lot of issues. There are lots of concerns raised. And we have to do a better job moving forward. As Kirsten pointed out, in the General Assembly, we get funding based on our average daily membership. And if we don't get our enrollment up, we lose roughly $10,000 per student every year that either doesn't come to school due to poor attendance or
leaves
the system because they didn't get into IB where they were qualified to be there. Or other concerns about our
middle
school. And
that's less money we have to maintain those buildings.
Exactly.
When we're talking about the IB program, 387 applicants. And then we have these half-empty schools.
Well, and the repurposing
and the fact that there's more applicants to open high than they can accept. These schools need to grow in size.
Sure they do.
And we should not lose those students to private schools.
The chairman of that committee has voiced those concerns pretty avidly that the board might ignore and is sidelining.
Well, I can only speak for this board member, and I don't intend to ignore the information and the hard work that came out of that committee process. I know that a lot of their frustration came from comments from another school board member who, even before the public hearings, went on the radio and said he spoke for the entire board, which I never had a conversation about it, but he was on the radio saying that no schools would be closed. And I think that was irresponsible. And I think it was very, he demonstrated a lack of respect for those folks who put in those hours and that hard work. And he doesn't speak for me. I can just only say that.
Sure. Gee, my knee.
Can we talk a little bit about, I guess, what these boundaries mean beyond just where a child is going to go to school? It's not a just, but attendance boundaries mean a lot, too, just in terms of real estate values, property taxes that the city is able to collect, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What sort of importance does the city council place in this process, Marty?
City council has not played very much a role at all. In fact, much of the work of the task force was going on while we were fighting and sometimes fighting each other over the budget. And so they were sort of parallel universe kinds of deals. I'm feeling real sad that I'm ignorant about this rezoning process. Because there's certain components of it that I am aware of that is just giving me cold chills. And I've expressed those tonight. The other, though, is that I've said it publicly, and I believe it is so, that if you're going to budget, you budget to needs. And I'm afraid that schools for the last 10 years has been budgeting based on a 10-year-old template, and we've just been fiddling around the edges.
Try 50-year-old template.
Could well be. Yet we get a new chief financial officer who comes in and takes a whack at actually building up a bottom-up budget, and whether the numbers are accurate or not, at least he tried to give us an honest budget based on need. And I think council needs to take that into account. I know the three of us who had supported them getting full funding understood that. The majority chose not to understand it. But then schools didn't sell it very well. Schools' hands aren't clean in this thing. But now my proposition before we pass that budget to the CAO is that, look, we don't have very much confidence in their numbers. Why don't we, as soon as possible, get the school's budget people, city budget people sent down and let us build some confidence in the numbers so that 3 months or 6 months down the road, we can get a mid-year correction and city can add additional funding to schools before we strip it completely bare and lay people off all over the place.
Well,
furloughs
we were talking
rip people's incomes to death.
About chickens and eggs. And is there a chicken and egg in I guess, you're trying to improve schools. You guys have the budget.
That's all we have.
You have the budget.
That's all we have.
Well, where your source of income is coming from to spend is largely based on the success of your school district.
Well, I get your point there. You're absolutely right. It's in our interest
that
we have a high-performance school system. And you're right. We haven't funded a high-performing school system. We've thrown money at something that we have not figured out what is our goal.
Well, doesn't a high-performing school system count on property values that draw people into an investing in a community?
Well, it does, but I dare say that that's less an issue right now because the city While we're not swimming in money, we're not hurting like so many other jurisdictions are. And it's we could have full-funded that budget and not hurt ourselves. And we didn't do it.
Well, I don't, know that it's personal.
Some of it did. Maybe. And let me finish this.
Well, I want to know what this personal stuff is.
There's one sentence left. Part of it was personal, and the other part was that schools did not exude a lot of confidence in their numbers.
It's very difficult to exude confidence in numbers that multiple audits have shown are not the most efficient way to operate. And I think it all comes down to resource allocation. And when we allocate resources to certain schools within the district and neglect others, right. It's similar to, you know, a non-custodial parent who pays child support. That custodial parent can decide to get a manicure, or they can decide to pay for a book for their child. So are we getting manicures? Are we going to pay for books? That's where the rub comes in. We want to make sure that all tax dollars are being spent to benefit children. And when these cuts came down, they came down on our teachers. They came down on class size. They came down, and there are multiple places that the school system could have cut. I made suggestions and put things on the table. We are hurting our children in this process, and they're getting scrambled up in this whole custody battle, as I use a long analogy. They are the ones being affected the most, and our children are in a crisis, and we need to put them first in every decision that we make.
Marty Jewell, city council member, Kim Gray, school board member, and Kirsten Gray, who's with APV, as well as...
Can I end on a positive
parent
note?
Please do.
Well, I will say my kids are still in Richmond Public Schools. There's a lot of people we love, and you can get a good education there.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But you
got to
be watchful. You got to be involved. And
that's with every school district,
yeah,
with every
parent. And your kid has to, you know that it's their job to make that choice to do well.
And I always say,
okay,
I
don't
excellent
that note,
teaching and learning takes place in Richmond Public Schools every day.
Every day.
Yeah,
every, my kids all attend Richmond Public Schools as well.
Absolutely. And again, thank you guys for coming. And that's Open Source.
Thank you.
A one, a two, a one, two, three, four.
Now I'm so glad the school is in. Now I can see my whole classmates again.
This has been Open Source RVA, Richmond's news and talk program. Do you have a story idea or a news tip? Would you like to give feedback on this week's show? Well, email us at opensourcerva@gmail.com. We'll see you next week at 4 p.m. for another edition of Open Source RVA.